Hello and welcome to Bright Wings, children's books to make the heart soar. I am your host, Charity Hill. The purpose of this conversation is to help mothers and fathers identify books that will liberate their children to embrace truth, goodness, and beauty. Do your children read fantasy? Maybe you're wondering, well, what is it? Maybe then I can tell you. So fantasy is a genre of literature. It's a kind of literature that involves adventuresome fictional stories in which magic is its distinguishing feature. Magic or supernatural elements set this kind of writing apart from other kinds of writing, such as historical fiction. The setting of the fantasy story may take place in other worlds or times. It may involve talking beasts or mythical creatures. The key element, though, to the fantasy genre is that it is fantastical, that there's something magical. Some people argue that fantasy is on the same spectrum as science fiction, and this can sometimes happen when this can sometimes happen when magic becomes super technological, or when the science fiction characters are doing things or have features or creatures that seem to be borrowed from fantasy, like dragons or unicorns. If you get really curious about all these distinctions, Tolkien talks about their fantasy involving beast stories and fairy stories, both. I found a really interesting statistics that suggests that for young people who are age 10 and up, fantasy is their preferred genre of literature. So I wonder, do you let your kids read fantasy? Should we let our kids read fantasy? And perhaps I'll just begin by saying, well, why wouldn't we? What could people possibly have against fantasy? It seems to me that the main objectors to fantasy as a genre are hardcore materialists, those who would exclude any magic or supernatural and are just very hardcore materialists, and they would want to eschew anything that wasn't, in fact, factual or real. And then perhaps the other objectors, well, let's face it, the main objectors to fantasy as a genre are religious conservatives. And it seems to me that their hesitation concerns magic itself, that if you're in the realm of magic, you may be in the realm of the demonic, that perhaps fantasy is necessarily associated with something evil or occult or demonic, something that isn't good. Now, what I love about this position is that it takes fantasy seriously. In fact, it takes fantasy even more seriously than some casual readers of it do, I think. The critics who are religious conservatives understand the power of imagination. They understand that imagination needs to be engaged with one's faith because reason and desire are fully ingredient to belief. Let me say this. I think if you don't read fantasy, you're missing out on a lot of dynamics, life, and color in your literary life. Just as if you wanted to understand Jesus, you would not miss his parables because they give you the dynamics of his person and of his kingdom. You definitely don't want to miss fantasy. I'm going to tell you why. I was mulling over these same issues in a text thread with some girlfriends of mine. We've been friends since graduate school, so a good 16, 17 years now. I thought I would share with you that conversation because sometimes it's helpful to hear what a community of other well-formed women thinks about these things. So let me tell you a little bit about each one. My friend Erin is a mother of 5 in Kansas. She homeschools and she co-directs a healing ministry. My friend Carla is from Virginia. She writes poetry. She has 6 children. She lives on a farm and she writes for various organizations. Oh, she's also getting her second master's in poetry. Yes. And then my friend Mandy is from Alabama, where she is newly married and is a neurologist. I wanted to share with you some of the insight these women gave to me. I tried to get them all organized to be part of this podcast, actually, but we could not make our schedules for the 4 of us align. So after months of waiting, I wanted to just share with you some of their insights, as well as some of my own insights on fantasy and magic. And then I want to offer you a book list. Yay, a book list of fantasy books that I would recommend. So I suggested to my friends that with fantasy, I thought magic was the sticking point. Magic is a tricky word, right? It means one thing for one author and another thing for another author. I just love these ladies because they see what's at stake. Mandy responded with, she said, "Hey, I'm in a classics book club and we just started reading The Odyssey." She says, "It occurs to me that every good story has something of the supernatural in it. And this has been the case before there was a fantasy genre." And she continues, she says, "We see the influence of the gods and the goddesses. We see goodness. We see magic. We see an interior strength from somewhere else. Whatever you call it, there's always a beyond that we humans are intrigued by." And then Mandy responds to my question about good magic and bad magic. Mandy proposes that good magic is a recognition that there's mystery at the heart of reality. And then my friend Aaron from Kansas takes up the question of what do we do with religious conservatives who say all magic is bad? Magic isn't trustworthy. It can be misleading or even harmful. Aaron says, "In a lot of ways, my early life was a case study in the value of magic in books." She says she received literally no religious instruction, but was allowed to read whatever she wanted. And even with plenty of junky sensational books with magic in them, thank you, Scholastic, she says. She says, "I was deeply implanted with magic as the sense of mystery that Mandy spoke about." What good does this do? She wonders. It weaves into my worldview. That's what a lot of reading does, right? It weaves things into our subconscious worldview. It wove it into my worldview that the belief that there is something beyond what I see, some mystery with a capital M, some beyond with a capital B, that there is something more than what I see. As an aside, Aaron doesn't say this. I'm saying this. Maybe that is what sort of the more arch conservatives are worried about, actually, is not being able to control this aspect that fantasy points to. Okay, back to Aaron. "There is something more than what I see. This prepared me," Aaron says. "It prepared me for the belief in God so naturally. And this belief in the more has the consequence of making the world safe to me because there is something more powerful than I am. I knew it as magic in the stories, but there is this something more powerful than I am that can save me if I get in trouble. Because ultimately, even in a world where horrific things happen, I am safeguarded in the eternal and often the temporal sense as well." Also, she writes, "Another consequence is if the world is magical, then there is drama and excitement. This may not seem as important as the other things, but when you're a mom of five and feel like you spend approximately 14 hours of the day cleaning the kitchen counter, a healthy abiding belief in life as dramatic and that God surprises us is very important." You gotta love that. And Carla totally just affirms what Aaron is saying. In fact, Carla sent me a PDF of Tolkien's essay on fairy stories. And so I'm going to try to link that in the show notes for y'all, because that's Carla's main argument. So fantasy suggests that there is a mystery at the heart of reality, that there is a mystery of goodness, that there is a promise of gladness, that there is even a promise of the victory of goodness. Another reason why fantasy as a genre in general is worth reading is that fantasy demands more from the imagination and therefore engages intelligence and reason and moral reasoning differently than other genres. Fantasy engages faith and hope in a particularly robust way. What do I mean? I mean faith in the sense that you are proposing an entirely imaginative world on the basis of what is known from this world. So on the basis of analogy. And it engages hope because though things seem impossible and perhaps there's this fight between good and evil, you have hope in the victory of good. So because of this dynamism, I think fantasy works on human desire of the reader differently than other genres. I mean, we know instinctively that these things hit us differently. That's why there are different genres. I mean, obviously, that's one of the reasons. But friends, let's think for a minute. think of how you would imaginatively engage a historical novel differently than you would imaginatively engage a fantasy novel. It's a very different world and a very different feel if you're going back to the 1800s than if you are going into a magical realm, where presumably evil needs to be defeated. And this brings me to reason number three why fantasy as a genre is worth reading. Number one was the mystery at the heart of reality. Number two is that fantasy as a genre demands more from our imagination and engages us in a different way. Reason number three is this. Fantasy is inherently more symbolic than other kinds of literature. Remember, getting across the prairie, building a farm, slaughtering a hog, these are hard. These are trials. There's drama here. There's definitely drama here that calls forth my response and my engagement. Right, you're facing down certain harms. This is beautiful and valuable. And I used to be that historical fiction was all I read growing up. Fantasy was for other people. But a drought or a tornado is not a personal evil. In fantasy, Sauron is a personal evil. Morgoth is a personal evil. The Horned King is a personal evil. The Witch Queen of Endor, Nemeyane, is a personal evil, and they need to be defeated. You may have to suffer more than hardships to defeat them. What does it mean that in fantasy the stakes are more cosmic? The struggles are more cosmic. And I want to affirm that I think one of the great values of fantasy literature is that it affirms the symbolic nature of reality. In human history, there has probably never been an era such as ours that has been so totally emptied of symbolic values. In our time and place, we're living in an era that's been emptied of the power of symbol. What do I mean? There is a poem called Trees by Joyce Kilmer, and it goes like this. I think I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree whose hungry mouth is pressed against the earth's sweet flowing breast, a tree that looks at God all day and lifts her leafy arms to pray. A tree that may in summer wear a nest of robins in her hair, upon whose bosom snow has lain, who lives intimately with rain. Poems are made by fools like me, but only God can make a tree. Now that was published in 1915, and just that long ago, somebody could write a poem in which a tree represented not only a poem, but somehow spoke of God. Just by being a tree. Now, if we even notice a tree, what we see when we see a tree is we see firewood. Nowadays, a tree is less than a tree. A tree is firewood. But in a fantasy book, what is a tree? A tree is a portal. A tree is a door to an ancient grove from more than a millennia ago. For far too many of us, a tree is not a poem. And few of us can handle a sustained analogy anymore. We can't use an extended metaphor. We don't think like that. We don't use analogies or metaphors in our day-to-day speech, probably, unless you live in a culturally rich, sort of verbally creative pocket of America. And if you live in one of those pockets, it's probably, I'm going to guess, either a rural place or a highly educated environment. But we really are living in a linguistic landscape that has been emptied of its symbols, and a human landscape that's been emptied of its symbols. And so it is interesting to me at what seems like an explosion of fantasy literature since I have become an adult. Perhaps this is a longing within the human person for symbols because our landscape is so bereft of them outside of literature. So perhaps even though our symbols have been emptied and they've been flattened and evacuated, I don't think we've lost our need for symbolic meaning and symbolic values. And perhaps that's precisely why fantasy as a genre is so popular, is it assures us that things are full, that things mean more than what they are, that things by being themselves have an interiority, and that interiority bears, that carries, that communicates a greater reality. Now, let me just take a second and clarify what I mean by symbolism. So what do I mean by a symbol? I guess like just to try to break down my terms a little bit, what I would say is a symbol is that a symbol is something that by being itself, it makes present another reality. A sign points. It points usually away from itself. A symbol is different. Consider water as symbolism. So precisely because water is naturally conveying cleanliness and life, it's a symbol of holiness and spiritual rebirth. So by being what it is, it communicates an other. It communicates another reality. A pregnant woman is a symbol. She makes, by being herself, by being what she is, who she makes present the embryonic other. And not only that, in a certain way, she makes present yet a third. She makes present her spouse. And the point is that symbolism is not just random. It's not just randomly assigned meaning. Symbolism has to do with the structure of reality. Water does not convey corruption or filth. It just can't communicate that. It can't symbolize corruption. Because that would be to contradict what the thing actually is already in itself. So it can't symbolize something that it is contradictory. So that's a quick summary of what symbols are and how they work. And I just want to express that they're a part of reality. Or rather, maybe that reality is symbolic. And to live in an era that's stripped of symbol, that generally operates without symbols, it's like living in a food poor home. You are still hungry. You still have deficits. You still have a need. And this is where fantasy comes in. It is in touch somehow with this hunger. Perhaps it's even a response, unconscious culturally, perhaps, but a response to this hunger for symbol, the hunger that we have for things to have meaning, for things to have depth. Maybe that's why there's been a proliferation in fantasy writing. It seems like there has been a proliferation. And what I appreciate about fantasy is that it takes the symbolic values of our world seriously, even as it creates alternative worlds. Fantasy gives us, as my friend Aaron says, a sense that there is something beyond what we can see, some mystery, some powerful goodness that can. The goodness, the power, might be hidden in a small flower. It might be hidden in some pollen. But precisely by that flower being what it is, it communicates this life, this goodness, this richness beyond itself. Someone who leans into this notion about magic and symbolism really profoundly, in a way I have not seen another current fantasy writer doing, is an author named N.D. Wilson. He is a preacher's son who went to college at St. John's College. He's a modern middle grade writer with a classical background, right? And he does a good job of showing what I'm talking about regarding magic. In N.D. Wilson's books, magic is what's natural. What do I mean by that? One of the premises of his books is that if we press into what is real, if we press into what is natural and really see it for what it is, there's magic. And what is that magic? What we're seeing is really just a recognition of the gratuity and the wonder and the power and the goodness that is the foundation of the natural. Just to give you an example of what I'm talking about from Wilson's books, Wilson wrote a book called The Door Before, which is a prequel. It's a kind of a keystone book to two different series that stem from this book called The Door Before. In The Door Before, we see a girl named Hyacinth Smith. She's just becoming conscious kind of this power within her where she can place her hands on natural things such as trees and ask them to do what they are naturally, to do what they do naturally. She can even do this with wood that has been made into furniture. She can place her hands on it, and it can act as a kind of door to other places where that same wood grows. Now, Wilson is basing this off this wonderfully classical notion from Plato that every oak tree is really an iteration of the form of oak tree, is one oak, essentially, that all oak trees in the world are branches off the one oak tree that is. Wilson gives us a great example of how magic can be understood in terms of the life of the world already as it is, or the life of the world in a more intensified, intentional way. If there's a subtext argument going on, it's that we don't see the magic of the world that we're living in. We miss it, but really, in fact, it's charged with the grandeur of God, as Hopkins calls it. I really like how Wilson talks about magic, good magic. It's clear from what I discussed that it's, in a certain sense, natural and tied up with the already apparent goodness of created reality. The evil character in The Door Before, Nimiani, she is really evil. She's incredibly creepy, actually. She's one of the scariest fictional characters I've met in quite a while. And this is a tense and tautly written book. And you don't leave Wilson thinking, magic is a neutral power. You can use good magic or bad magic. No, in his understanding, evil magic literally sucks up the power of life, of good magic. It literally sucks up the power of human life, plant life, animal life, and human life to affirm itself, to prolong its own power in existence by literally kind of vampiring the life and power, the vitality of others. Now, that's a depiction of evil I can get behind. Evil as an evil magic as parasitic or vampiric, that's pretty great. But I get you. There's plenty of questionable depictions of magic out there. Let me tell you about one of the ways magic is used that really bugs me. And it's this. I wonder what happens to a fantasy world and its ethics, its characters, and frankly, its ontology when technology replaces magic. What I mean is, if magic is understood to be just really advanced technology, is it magic? I think not. It's not a symbol of anything. It doesn't speak. It doesn't point. It's just technology. And I wouldn't even call it magic. This is what I mean by how some authors use the word magic, and they don't mean the same thing that other authors mean when they are using the term magic. Magic, which operates essentially as technology, it's this magic we see in Artemis Fowl. And I grant you, I actually liked it better than I thought I was going to. It's really well-paced in terms of its style of writing. They do a lot of showing, not telling. But it's really not a science. It's really not a fantasy book. I want to say, I think it's more like a science fiction book that happens to have characters called fairies that happen to have interests in natural events, like moonrises and solstices. It's a very sleek, gadgety kind of magic. More like James Bond than Tolkien. The magic in Artemis Fowl doesn't point to anything. It doesn't touch on any mysteries. Yeah, the magic in Artemis Fowl is not natural. It's not rooted in the being of things. Sometimes in Tolkien, you know, the wizard Saruman, his magic is rooted in the is predatory upon the goodness of things, the way evil always is, and it harnesses that goodness and derives its power from the goodness of things to take elves and men, right, and make and twist them. That's what we should be talking about when we're talking about bad magic. But now what we're talking about is magic that corresponds to the deepest truths of being, or magic that is technological. So I guess if we're going to keep our terms straight, we've got good magic and bad magic. That's kind of between the good guys and the bad guys' powers. And then we have technological magic. We see a lot of technological magic in that obnoxious series by Shannon Messenger, the Keeper of the Lost Cities series. Before I go too far into discussing particular books, I'm going to do that in a minute. Just want to summarize where we're at so far. So I think fantasy as a genre is a really great genre. It's really a genre worth reading because it offers us so much. It affirms that there's a mystery at the heart of reality, that there's a mystery of goodness, a promise of gladness. Fantasy as a genre demands more from the imagination and therefore demands more of our intelligence and our reason, our moral reasoning, and it engages us in a particular way. And then something else that is so valuable about fantasy that's hard to find in other genres to this degree is that fantasy affirms that reality is symbolic, that reality bears the wonder of another reality within itself. That reality is full of analogies that carry forward rich meaning. And fantasy affirms this hunger in the human person that longs to know that things have depth. And then the last thing that we just discussed is that, yes, there's good magic and bad magic, and that's good. I mean, that's right, because there's goodness and evil. So there's good magic and bad magic, and then there's poorly done magic, which is technological magic, which is maybe evidence that the flattening and the emptying out of things has even made itself present in the fantasy genre. So now that you know what's informing my thinking, I figured I would tell you about some of the books that are on the book list and some of the books that I left off the book list. First, I should let you know that if it's not on the book list, it doesn't mean necessarily that I hate it. It may just mean that I haven't read it or that I forgot about it. And drumroll, please, because this is where I bring up the Harry Potter series. This part isn't going to make anybody happy, neither the pros nor the cons to the Harry's defenders or antagonists. And I am asked about this all the time. Probably every 10th question, at least, is would I recommend them or not for their children? And I can't tell you that I would. I do know that I don't have a lot to say about it. I'm going to tell you about three things. The first is we haven't read it. I never read it growing up because I was a little bit too old when it got started, and that was like kids' books, and so I wasn't going to read it. And then it became very popular, which was also a reason I wasn't going to read it. but I have never let my children read it. And I haven't felt like we're missing out. I don't feel like there's a big loss. I know there are good Christian people who have been positively influenced by these books. There are some profoundly Christian notions of love and sacrifice in Harry Potter. That's my understanding. But I also want to say, perhaps it's reasonable to be cautious, though, when you hear exorcists report that Harry Potter books were ingredient in possessions from which they delivered people. I don't know, guys. I'm just saying. It's kind of odd. I guess if I can't decide and there's no imperative to take action, then I don't. So yeah, we have not read the Harry Potter series here at Hill House. I have friends whose children have read them and love them. One is a moral theologian. Yikes. So I don't know, guys. I don't know. I should probably have that moral theologian on Bright Wings and just do an episode on the Harry Potter series. Ask her why. What's her rationale? Maria, if you're listening, call me. At this point, I'm going to plunge in and highlight some titles from the book list. And I'm going to begin with the series by Lloyd Alexander, known as the Black Cauldron series. The Black Cauldron is actually the second book in the series, and it made famous the whole series because it won the Caldecott. The series really begins with the book titled The Book of Three, and it concerns Taryn, the main character, Taryn, the assistant pig keeper. We are currently reading this aloud. I am currently reading this aloud to my fourth grade twins at bedtime, and it's hard to actually get them to bed on time. I love this series. It's squeezing my heart as I read it to them. It's really kind of a paradigm, I think, for children's fantasy. And starting in fourth grade, they could read it to themselves and get so much out of it. Younger than that, they might miss some of the interior drama, which is quite beautiful and really well done. Not too psychological, but definitely asks the reader to examine what is motivating the characters. So there's plenty of external adventure, and that keeps you turning the pages. It's true that the chapters do sometimes end on cliffhangers, just to let you know. But there's so much interior drama and character development that grips your heart. My twins and I, we really love each character. I mean, when I'm reading, I'm sometimes looking over at them when certain characters say certain things. One of the characters is a bard named Fafluter Flam. Well, I say his name Fafluter. Anyway, it might be just Fluter, but we like to say it Fafluter Flam. And And Gergi, this other creature, they are all, we just look at each other and love these characters. Okay, and so their friendship, they develop, they go on these adventures together, and their friendship develops as well as each character develops. You see them each change through different things that they've suffered, through different hardships they endure. They are not perfect, but they are believable and lovable. There's so much warmth in this series. It's a series that I didn't even read until a couple of years ago. Back in early middle school, Mark was reading them, and I remember he spent all of lunch one day telling me about this series, but I still didn't read it. Mark, you were right. It's amazing. It's a series that's kind of a preparatory series for The Lord of the Rings. If you love and aim at The Lord of the Rings as kind of the pinnacle of fantasy writing, definitely the Black Cauldron series is a series that affirms much of the same worldview, but for much younger readers. So I'd put it at, you could read it, if you've got a great reader, it's safe for them to read in third grade probably. And I don't know that you would ever outgrow it. I really enjoyed, personally really enjoyed reading it. It's one of those perfect series, especially if you're a parent who is very sensitive about magic and whether it's okay or not. This is a great series. A series that I started with in the past 6 weeks or so is the Ranger's Apprentice series by the Aussie author John Flanagan. It's not necessarily a bad observation, just funny, but I was reading the first book from Lloyd Alexander called The Book of Three, and I couldn't help but notice that I thought the Ranger's Apprentice, first book of the Ranger's Apprentice series, just had almost so many similarities between the two books. Both the main characters are mysterious orphans. Both become apprentices. Both desire to be grand and noble. Now, that isn't to say the Ranger's Apprentice is a knockoff. I'm just saying there are some very similar plot devices. I have only read the first book of The Ranger's Apprentice. So far, I would recommend it. I've got the second one coming. It's ordered, but I have not read the second book in the series of The Ranger's Apprentice. John Flanagan also made prequels to The Ranger's Apprentice series. So there is a lot there if it's good. I just don't know if it is thoroughly, thoroughly good. Okay, so let me know if you have information on that that would help us, okay? I love hearing from you, and you can email me at brightwingschildrensbooks@gmail.com, and I will actually answer it. I will actually get it. I know it looks like it's being sent to a droid or something, but it's just me, and it will probably take me a month to get back to you. But if you know the Ranger's Apprentice series thoroughly, I would love to talk to you. Being up to my eyeballs in Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas and whatnot this year, I just cannot master that amount of reading material outside of my teaching. So let me know. Just to let you know, the book list is going to be a huge mix of different ages, and some of it you may even argue is sci-fi. So sorry about that. I just put it on there anyway because I'm probably not going to do a podcast on sci-fi. And also things like Till We Have Faces. When am I going to be able to put that on a book list if I don't put it on this one? So C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, one of my favorite books ever. I'm also throwing on the book list, you know, very much lower quality literature like The Castle in the Attic and The Battle for the Castle. I really enjoyed reading them growing up. I discovered, speaking of books for much younger children, super charming series called Cat Wings by Ursula Le Guin about some kitties that are born in a city, and they all these kittens have wings. Excellent writing, adorable illustrations, perfect for kindergarten and up. There are boy and girl kitties in this little series. To circle back to an author that I just mentioned, Ursula Le Guin, the author of the cute little Cat Wings books, she also wrote a series called The Books of Earthsea, and the first book in that series is A Wizard of Earthsea. Le Guin is an excellent writer. There is a male protagonist, and there's plenty of exterior action, but what is remarkable is how introspective these books are. There's a great deal of drama happening within the main character. In the first book, you realize that actually all the exterior drama has been generated by an interior drama. I'm not going to give anything away because it's really good. But I wanted to bring up this series because although it is super good, I'm recommending them with just a little bit of caution, a little bit of awareness. So I wanted to tell you about these books. So as I read them, it kind of begins with, the book kind of opens with a dualistic assumption of light and darkness informing its cosmology. There are a lot of really good proposals about wisdom, about self-knowledge. I wanted to alert you that I think it's that I, as I was reading, I thought, oh, this is a little bit of, it just seems a little kind of Eastern in its vibe and its proposals and its spirituality. Some of the mentors in the book speak in kind of wise aphorisms. That's good. There's a lot that's valuable there. One of the large concerns in the doing of magic in Earthsea is the maintenance of balance, of equilibrium. So I couldn't help myself. But after I finished the first book in the series, I looked up Le Guin on the internet. I try to just let the books speak for themselves. But if I get really curious, then I look up what's going on in the author. And Le Guin, sure enough, very interestingly, called herself as a-religious as a jackrabbit. But in fact, I think she just meant sort of non-Christian. So she did have an interest in Taoism, which is interestingly concerned with equilibrium and balance. Now, I just want to say it's not as if reading these books are going to, it's not as if Le Guin is a Buddha evangelist or a Tao evangelist. It's not like that at all. It's very subtle, and many of these things are very wise, and there's a great deal to be affirmed in these notions of self-restraint and self-control and stewardship. In Christianity, there is this, if this is your concern as a Christian, is there still is in Christianity a lot of beautiful paradoxes, like the kingdom of heaven is within, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The only way to preserve your life is to lose it. It's only in dying that we are reborn, right? So Le Guin has a lot of good things to say. I just wanted to tell you there's about the dualism. Actually, it's just mostly in the first book, there's this assumption of dualism. Okay. And what I mean by dualism is like co-eternal good and evil or co-eternal darkness and light. Darkness actually isn't evil. So it's not a co-eternal good and evil. It's co-eternal darkness and light. Darkness is not necessarily bad in this cosmology. Does that make sense? So that's a little bit different than the way we usually make the proposal in the West. Like I said, Le Guin is not a Buddha evangelist or a Taoism evangelist. It's generally just really good storytelling. And I would let my children read it, which is why I put it on the book list. It's a very robust book list. I hope that you find things on it that you love. It has everything from Mrs. Pigglewiggle, where the magic is, maybe if it isn't mechanical, it's medicinal, to Watership Down, to Wind in the Willows. Those are probably more like beast stories, Tolkien would say. I've included The Trumpeter of Krakow by Eric P. Kelly, as well as The Trumpet of the Swan by E.B. White. I've even included The Chocolate Touch, as well as Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Fantasy is a broad place. I'm giving you a really robust book list, and I hope that you find something in it to nourish and engage your imagination. It would be so kind of you to share this episode with a family member or a friend who enjoys fantasy or whose children enjoy fantasy. Please follow this podcast if you don't yet so that I know you're out there. And if you can stand to pay for shipping, please, it would really help me out if you buy any books from the book list from the link in the show notes. In the show notes, I have a link to a PDF, a printable PDF of the fantasy book list. I will also have a link straight to my bookshop site where you could purchase books where I receive 10% of the cost of your book.